This is Digital Story Podcast number 1033, January 6, 2026. Today's theme is, I thought my iPhone shots were fine, until I didn't. I'm Derek Story. As I mentioned last week, my iPhone has saved me countless times. Plus, it's so convenient. So much so that when I'm working on an article, I often pull it out of my pocket for a few quick illustration snaps. But then I had an interesting revelation that caused me to recalibrate. I'll share that story on today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. I'm working on an article that I'm going to publish a little bit later this week on Digital Story, and it needs some illustrations. So along the way, as I was testing this item, it's a review item. Along the way, as I was testing this item, I would take shots with my iPhone 17 Pro, and I would pay careful attention. I mean, I wasn't just doing random snapshots. I was, you know, lining up the shot well, making sure the lighting was decent. It was a little low because I was depending on a north window, and I had a little ambient light to go with it, but it was reasonable lighting. And so the composition, you know, I paid attention to that. You know, all the things that you do when you're trying to get a nice shot, a nice illustration shot, in this case, a nice product shot. So I was working on the pictures, and I got a few done, and they were all iPhone shots. And I called it a day. So the next morning I come in, and I go, I had been thinking about this article, and I go, boy, you know, I need a couple more shots. I need like a hero shot for the top of the article and this and that. Figured I needed about three more shots. So I set everything up again, and, you know, the lighting and all that kind of stuff. Had the composition good. Had the items placed the way that I wanted them for the shot. And I decided, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and use my Fujifilm X100V for these shots. You know, I'm not like multitasking or anything. I can really focus on the photography. And I have it, you know, accessible here in the studio. I can just grab it and shoot. So I pulled it out and lined up the shot, did my settings. And I'm going, yeah. You know, the one thing I noticed in the iPhone shots was there's a little bit more detail in the background than I wanted. So I said, you know, I'm going to open up the aperture a bit. I do all of that stuff, do the exposure compensation, get the aperture priority. I take my three shots, process them, load them up onto my computer, and then I drop them in the same folder with my iPhone shots. So now I'm feeling like I've got everything that I need so I can write the draft. And the next step that I usually do is that I select all the shots in the folder, in my illustrations folder, and I open them up in preview, and I just kind of, you know, browse through them. Now, the reason why I do this is that when I look at any individual shot just by itself, that's cool. I go, okay, that looks good, or I need to do this or that. But when I'm going through the whole folder of shots from one shot to the next, I really notice things, how things change. I really notice, you know, if there's a color shift or if there's a quality shift, so to speak, or, you know, any number of little things like that. So I think it's important, at least for me, that I go through the whole group of shots in one sitting and go from one to another. Doing that, and I started out with the iPhone shots because I had shot them earlier. And they look good, and I was happy with them. I mean, I thought they looked good. I was very happy with them. I'm going through them, and then I get to the first X100 shot, and I'm looking at it, and I go, wow, that's really nice. And then I go to the next X100 shot, and I go, that one's pretty nice too. Then I go back to the iPhone shots, and I go, what's wrong here? They don't look as good as I thought they did before I had the X100 shots. So then I'm kicking into a different mode. Now I want to analyze what the heck is going on here. And so that's what I'm going to share with you right now, what that analysis rendered. And what it rendered was that there was a substantial difference between the iPhone shots and the X100 shots. Now, I know for some of you, I feel like I'm stating the obvious here. Of course, there's going to be differences, right? I know that. And we are talking about web publishing. So who knows if people are going to see the differences the way that I'm seeing them when I'm looking at the original shots on my monitor. But it is substantial. And let me tell you some of the things that I notice that are different. Let's start with the iPhone shot. So when I look at it, it's nice and crisp. The iPhone did a good job of managing the color. The color balance was quite good on it. The colors were pretty decent. Everything is nice and sharp. Everything is nice and sharp. You know, going back to the background and things like that. But I started thinking, okay, when I go back to the Fujifilm shot, it's sharp too, but it's sharp in a different way. It's not annoyingly sharp, if you know what I say. It's not digitally sharp. There's some little line art on this. There are some words, you know, that are engraved on the device. You know, there's all sorts of little things there to look at. There's the actual texture of the outer coating. So I'm looking at those in the Fujifilm shot. They're sharp, but they're not annoying. They're just pleasantly sharp. And the photo looks very pleasing. And then I also noticed that since I shot at a wide aperture, f2 on these, because I lined up the composition on a plane, so I thought I could get away with f2 and not be burned, which I did. I got away with it this time. And the background just looks, you know, fantastic. You know, the items are back there. It's in a kitchen. The items are back there, but they're softened just so that they're not annoying. So they give you environment, they give you presence, but they're not distracting to the main subject. I'm looking at the X100 shot and sort of reveling in all of this. The fall off is so wonderfully smooth. The way that the detail is rendered. The colors, of course, are very nice. And then I go back to the iPhone shot, which I thought was quite good originally. And I'm going, It's too digital. And it doesn't look natural. The edges are too sharp. When I zoom in on it, which I don't normally do for, you know, anything that's going to go on the web, but I was curious, right? I wanted to know what was going on here. And it's edgy. And I think edgy is a very good word for it. So even though it's crisp in one sense, it's edgy in another sense. And in fact, it was so edgy after I'd been looking at the Fujifilm shots that I opened up the iPhone shots in Luminar Neo and I used a little bit of Orton effect to kind of tone down that edginess a bit, and it really needed it. So I would do like, you know, 25% on the slider. And I go, no, that actually needs a little bit more. That's up to like 35 or 40% on the Orton effect slider to get that thing to tame that shot so that it would come back in and look pleasing and not digitally. I was just fascinated by this whole process. And of course, the background had a lot of detail, more detail than I wanted. Now, one trick that I do with the iPhone is that you can get away many times shooting in portrait mode, and it will soften that background for you. Although it does it differently than optically with a camera like our OM system or Fujifilm or Nikon or Sony or whatever we happen to be using. It does it differently, but it does help. I wasn't doing that on this particular shoot because I wasn't really thinking about all of this stuff that I later realized. Also, the colors, I wouldn't say they feel false, but they feel wrong a little bit. They feel a little too enhanced, maybe. And so I had to kind of back those off a bit. I kind of toned them down. So I'm going back and forth on these shots. And finally, it's so funny, the shots that I had to spend time working on in post were the iPhone shots. Not so much the Fujifilm shots. Once I did the color correction on the Fujifilms, I was pretty much done. I did a little bit of cropping as well. So I pulled the iPhone shots back in line with what I saw with the Fujifilm shots. And then I was a lot happier. Now, of course, when people read the article, unless they listen to this podcast, they're not going to be, you know, thinking about any of this. I think all of the shots, you know, really add to the article. They help you understand what I'm talking about, you know, all that good stuff. So they definitely serve their purpose. Folks that have listened to this podcast will probably be looking at the illustrations a little bit differently when it publishes and going, yeah, that is an iPhone shot, isn't it? So where does that leave me with all of this? Well, obviously, I'm not down on the iPhone at all. It's a device that I love. It's a device that has saved me many times, including last week. I haven't changed my opinion on any of that. What I have changed my opinion just a bit on is that because the smartphone is so convenient and so easy to use, I think I was using it more than I should have. And it was sort of like, let me see. Oh, I know what. It's sort of like when I gain weight. Just bear with me on this for a moment. So when I gain weight, I stray off the diet that I know I should have. You know, I know exactly what type of foods I should eat. I know how much I should drink. You know, I know all that kind of stuff. And then what happens is sometimes, like this time of year is a great example. Well, there are cookies out, which there normally aren't. So I have just a couple cookies. And then, you know, so that's like before Christmas. And then Christmas I have maybe, instead of just having one or two cookies, I have three or four cookies. And then by New Year's, you know, I'm having a half a dozen cookies. And I've also gained 5 pounds, right? That it just sort of creeps, right? You just sort of creeps. Once I lose my discipline, then it's just a matter of time till I get to a place I don't want to be. I was kind of doing that with the iPhone too, because I really had delineated, you know, when I use my cameras and then when I use the smartphone. And the smartphone was relegated to when I'm out doing walks, family pictures on the fly, quick shots for articles, you know, the ideas, information shots, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then saving the stuff that I'm going to publish or stuff that was more meaningful for me for the regular cameras. And I started kind of letting the iPhone creep into that other area where my regular camera stuff, because it's convenient, because it's in my pocket. Even though in this case, you know, the X100 was 15 feet from where I was on a shelf. You know, it wasn't hard to grab. So now we're talking about really lazy, right? But it just became a little bit of habit. It's like going from, you know, no cookies suddenly to 4 cookies. And that's what I was doing with the iPhone. What this lesson has taught me is to ratchet things back. In other words, go back to the original plan, go back to my original diet, you know, go back to how I know things work properly. Save the smartphone for the things that it's good at and the things that I need it for, and then use the camera when I should be using the camera and not the smartphone. So it was a very illuminating lesson for me. And since I had this revelation and it was top of mind, I just wanted to share it with you too. I have a couple news items this week I want to talk about. And this first one I think is pretty interesting. The compact camera comeback is real. Why people want dedicated cameras again. Kind of dovetails onto what I was just talking about, right? This is an article that's on F-Stoppers, and I have a link in the show notes. I'm going to read you just a little bit about it, and then you can go back and read the rest on your own. The compact camera is supposed to be dead. For the better part of a decade, that was the industry consensus. Smartphone cameras got good enough, the logic went, and nobody needed a separate device just to take pictures. The numbers supported this. From a peak of roughly 120 million units shipped in 2010, compact camera sales collapsed to a small fraction of that by the end of the decade. Analysts wrote eulogies. Manufacturers quietly discontinued product lines. The compact camera joined the portable CD player and the standalone GPS unit in the graveyard of technologies killed by the smartphone. Except something changed. CIPA's mid-2025 shipment data shows fixed-lens cameras up notably year over year. With a little over a million units moved in the first half of the year, the strongest performance since 2021. More telling than the unit numbers is what happened to the value. Shipment revenue has been climbing steadily since 2020, even while volumes stayed depressed, a clear signal that buyers are paying premium prices for the compacts they do purchase. At CP Plus 2025, Canon executive acknowledged that the category had bottomed out roughly 1/40th of its peak, but noted that the company was seeing early signs of renewed interest. The compact camera, as it turns out, is not dead. It is smaller, more expensive, and culturally repositioned, but is very much alive. The story of the compact camera comeback is really two stories that happen to share a trend line. The first story is about premium enthusiast compacts. This is the world of the Fujifilm GFX100RF, a genuinely remarkable product that stuffs a 102-megapixel medium format sensor into a body with a fixed 35mm f4 lens. It already picked up the industry award recognition and represents Fujifilm's bet that there is a market for photographers who want medium format image quality without the bulk of interchangeable lens system. Sony made a similar bet by reviving its full-frame RX1 line after nearly a decade of dormancy with the RX1 R3. Ricoh released the GR4, the biggest upgrade in the history of its cult favorite street photography compact, and even the six-year-old Canon PowerShot G7X Mark III continues to rank highly at major retailers with demand that has refused to fade even as Canon pivots its compact strategy toward video-focused PowerShot V1. What unites these cameras is design philosophy built around a constant: fixed lenses engineered specifically for their sensors, distinctive color science, physical controls that invite deliberate operation. The product is the limitation, and the limitation is the point. The second story is about Gen Z, TikTok, in the hunt for Y2K-era digicams. This is the world of vintage Sony CyberShots and Nikon Coolpix cameras from the early 2000s, selling for inflated prices on eBay, or the Kodak Charmera, the blind box keychain camera that gamified the unboxing experience by randomizing which color buyers received, or the screenless devices like the Camp Snap, that market themselves exactly as the anti-phone. Canon revived the PowerShot ELF 360 HSA, a reissue of the 2016 model, specifically to meet demand from buyers who want something that looks and feels like the cameras they remember from childhood. In this market, low resolution is a feature rather than a bug. Grain, flash artifacts, and what photography establishment would call imperfect rendering are precisely what buyers are paying for. The aesthetic is the product. These two markets have almost nothing in common except timing. The GFX 100RF buyer and the Charmera buyer are not the same person, are not solving the same problem, and would probably not understand each other's purchase decisions. But they are both buying compact cameras in 2025, and that convergence is what makes the trend legible to manufacturers and analysts. So then he drills down a bit in this article, TikTok as an engine. And I'm going to read you this paragraph here because I think it's pretty good. You cannot explain the compact camera revival without talking about TikTok. The platform's hashtag for digital camera has accumulated tens of billions of views. The broader Y2K hashtag, which encompasses fashion, music, and technology from the late 1990s and early 2000s, runs even higher, pushing a staggering 100 billion. This is a generational aesthetic movement with photography at its center. The trend has identifiable origin points. In 2023, a format emerged on TikTok comparing portraits taken on phones with the same shots captured with a dedicated camera like the Canon PowerShot G7X. Many users thought the phone photos looked flat and overprocessed, while the Canon photos had warmth, dimension, and character. These comparison videos spread quickly, each demonstrating the same basic finding. Dedicated cameras produce images that look meaningfully different from smartphone output. Subsequent attention from celebrities like Kendall Jenner, all of whom have posted digital aesthetic photos on their accounts, amplified the signal further. There's more on the TikTok, by the way, but the next subhead is the anti-computational backlash. The phrase friction with phones does a lot of work in explaining the compact revival, but it deserves unpacking. What exactly is the friction, and why does it matter enough to drive purchasing decisions? The core complaint, expressed across countless TikTok videos and Reddit threads, is that smartphone photos look fake, whatever that means. Users describe phone images as a little too crisp and criticize the way computational processing handles scenes. It is often referred to as a vibe. That word, vibe, appears constantly in discussions of compact cameras. It gestures at something that technical specifications cannot capture. So he goes on about that. Now, I want to say that vibe is something that I was seeing in my comparison photos too, and that my X100 shots had a very pleasing vibe. And they did not look overprocessed. They did not look too edgy. They did not look all those things. Whereas the vibe with the iPhone shots, and again, these are product shots. You know, we're not talking about snaps on vacation, stuff like that. These are product shots where you really are staring at the detail and looking at the intricate parts of the photo. They did look more edgy, more overprocessed, more digital. So I get exactly what people are talking about. Then they get into experience over output. And this is something that many of us will agree upon, that it's just more fun to take pictures with a dedicated camera than it is with a smartphone. You know, it's fun to have that shutter button. It's fun to have those dials. It's fun to have that nice grip, all those good things. And then we're going to wrap up here with what the subhead says, the foreground experience. Phones optimize photography into a background activity. The camera is always in your pocket, always ready, always connected. Taking a photo requires no preparation and no commitment. The special feeling of pulling out of the camera that I remember from 1997 isn't there. The result is that we take more photos than ever before and value each one less. Photography has become a reflex rather than an intention, a background process running constantly rather than a foreground activity we choose to engage. Compact cameras are selling the opposite. They are selling the foreground experience, the decision to bring a specific tool, the specific act of using it, the creative constraints it imposes, the distinctive look it produces. Whether that tool is a $6,000 medium format Fujifilm or a $30 Kodak keychain camera, the underlying proposal is the same. You are buying intentionality. You are buying the feeling that the photos you take with this device are yours in a way that phone snapshots never quite feel. The most interesting thing about the compact camera comeback is not that people want better photos. By most technical measures, phones already produce better photos than many of the compacts flying off shelves. What people want is photos that feel like theirs, images marked by the specific character of a specific tool they choose to use for reasons they can articulate in a process they controlled. That feeling, it turns out, is worth paying for. And the market is proving it. So this is just a terrific article. And like I said, I only read a fraction of it. There's a lot more. It's by Alex Cook. It's on F-Stoppers, and I have a link to it in the show notes. Until a photo is printed, it's just a jumble of binary code buried on a hard drive. It's time to be your own biggest fan and start printing your favorites. This is an article on Digital Camera World. I have a link in the show notes. I'm not going to read you very much of this article, but it is here for the reading, and I think you should. Let me read you a little bit from the intro. For decades, inkjet printers have often been the subject of fear and loathing, earning a notorious reputation along the way, especially for photo printing. Common complaints include prints coming out the wrong size on the page, colors being wrong, and images looking too dark. However, all of that usually can be very easily rectified by paying a little attention to the settings in your printer driver, matching them to the right size and type of paper you're using, and applying even approximate calibration to your monitor screen. Then there's the cost. Buy a brand new inkjet printer and the cartridges might seem to run out almost as soon as you set up a printer and printed a few photos. And guess what? A replacement set of cartridges might cost even more than the printer itself. But here's the thing. I love creating proper photo prints from my digital images with one of the best photo printers. Indeed, I've spoken with professional photographers in the past who have said they view printing their photos as the final step in the creative process, and that until a photo is printed, it is just a jumble of binary code buried on a hard drive. I also happen to think that a printed photograph reveals levels of detail that are completely missed on the monitor screen, and that they demand to be viewed in a way that on-screen images simply can't offer. So what's the answer? I have to confess that I've often wanted to create prints from some of my digital photos, but the cost has put me off. That's before I discovered my new best friend and creative partner in the shape of a Canon PIXMA G650, G620, or G660, as sold in Europe, USA, and Australia, respectively. This is the printer that I have talked about repeatedly. His point being, however, that finding a printer, whether it's this printer or a different printer, that he connected with, so to speak, found easy to use, then encouraged him to print more, and he kind of got this vicious cycle going in the right direction, and then the benefits of printing. So it's a good article, and if you're shopping for a very affordable printer that prints great and that is cheap to operate, this Canon is also a good choice. Let's take a look at a little virtual camera club news. I'm going to start out with workshops and webinars. We're going to do both. The first thing I want to talk about is our first webinar is coming up this Saturday, January 10 at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern. How to make the most of your workshop experience. And we thought we would start out with this webinar at the start of workshop season. It makes sense, right? When you attend a photography workshop, you want to maximize your shooting time and get the most of value for your hard-earned money. This program is full of tips, techniques, and ideas to help make the most of your time in the field. And this is going to be led by Rob Knight and myself. 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon. We'll probably go for an hour, hour and a half. This webinar is only $10. Only $10 for this webinar. If you haven't signed up already, you can sign up right now by going to the link in the show notes or by going to the workshops page on the Digital Story or the Nimble Photographer. And it gets even better for Inner Circle Bold members. This webinar is free for them. If you're an Inner Circle Bold member, all you have to do is send me an email to dstory@gmail.com. Say, I want to be part of how to make the most of your workshop experience webinar, and I'll get you signed up right away, no cost to you. Later in the month, beginning on January 28th, we have a workshop that falls very much in line with what I've been talking about today, mobile photography with the iPhone, iPad, and camera. So this is going to help you integrate these different devices into a workflow that is custom to you, but allows you to leverage the right tool for the right job, very much like I was talking at the top of the podcast today. Plus, I have all sorts of wonderful tips for you, techniques, software. It's really a fun workshop that I think you would enjoy. And that begins on January 28th. And again, you can get to it by going to our workshops page on The Digital Story or The Nimble Photographer. And Inner Circle members get 10% off this workshop. Speaking of Inner Circle members, I want to give a shout out to them. A big thanks for supporting this community and this podcast. Going to be hanging out with a number of Inner Circle members at the webinar. And then, of course, in the workshops because of the discounts or because they get to attend for free. And that's one of the reasons why I think they're Inner Circle members is because they want to be active. They want to participate. They want to work with their fellow photographers in this community. And they want to do so at a cost-effective price. And that's what Inner Circle membership allows. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of The Digital Story. Nose around a bit, sign up, and the next thing you know, you'll be getting an email from me and getting you set up in the Inner Circle. I think it's super enjoyable, and I hope that you make your New Year's resolution in 2026 to join us. And finally, I want to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of The Digital Story. You know, we're talking about that article that is really just a bunch of zeros and ones till it ends up on paper. Well, you know, I'm not going to go that far, but what I am going to say is that when I print a picture and I live with it for a bit and I have it hanging around the house or hanging around the studio, I feel like I know it a lot better. And that if I go back and work on that picture some more, that I go back with a broader palette of knowledge, even if that shot's just going to exist in an article or, you know, some other digital format, seeing it printed helps me understand it better, regardless of what medium that it ends up being shared with. And this is the kind of thing that Red River Paper can help us with. They provide the paper, they provide the knowledge and the know-how to help us understand our photography better through inkjet printing. They have a tile on all the pages of The Digital Story. You can go over there, nose around a bit, read some articles, read some reviews, and yes, order some paper. Make sure you use our code, our discount code, on the landing page to get free shipping. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.